And welcome everyone to another episode of All Things Trek. I'm Oren.
I'm Grace.
I am David.
And that was a pretty cool interview you guys just finished. I was listening to the tail end of it. You sounded so happy and full of joy.
Oh, because it's going to be awesome. Destination Star Trek in Frankfurt, Germany. So many great celebrities, panels, activities, and some tidbits, and even some stuff that wasn't revealed yet. So we're just going to look forward to that. Trek Radio is sending some people to Germany, so we're going to have lots of coverage of that. So I'm looking. It was just awesome, and we got to meet Jill from Media 10.
It sounds like it's going to be an amazing event.
It was just happiness all around.
All right, well, it's time to ruin your happiness by talking about Enterprise. Ba-dum-tsh. But first,
Okay.
We've got an email that's been sitting out, hanging out here for like 2 weeks, so I want to answer it real quick.
Alrighty then.
From our friend Mr. John Macy. It says, "Hello all. I've read the JJ vs. Kirk's a Lady comic. Let me spare you by saying it's awful. It's 22 pages of novelty with no story and gender swaps the crew for purely the sake of it. I've generally liked the series, but this was the worst of the 29 issues by far. I loved Grace's Denise Crosby show. Well, I've never liked Yar, the fact that
Thank
I was
you.
10 years... Yeah, yeah, he, you know, it was a good show. I liked it too. I thought that was a very strong episode. And it had, like, a really good Photoshop picture on it. The fact that I was 10 years old when TNG 1 season aired, I was never aware of the behind-the-scenes stuff behind her exit. CeeLo's kind of a wasted opportunity. I wonder if they had originally intended for her to be on the show more. I can only assume... I don't know. Seems... I do agree that CeeLo was a wasted opportunity.
She is used pretty well on Star Trek Online right now, though. Why do I keep plugging that game? Who knows?
No,
maybe I just want them to give me some free, you know, lockbox keys.
Oh, you lockbox
so
keys.
Ask.
Why don't you just pay them lots of money, Grace? That's what they want.
Because money.
They want your money. You're a bad player for not spending money on the game. Deal with that.
All right.
I'm going to finish this. I'm going to finish this email.
Continue.
The Zindi Arc show was fun, and I'm looking forward to future ones. If this goes well, would you ever do things like smaller Enterprise arcs or the DS9 final chapter arc? I know you guys have tried to stay away from episode recaps, though. I had an idea for a future show, unless you've already done it. All things Garak. In my opinion, Garak is the strongest supporting character in all of Trek, and there's a lot you could go into with him as an individual or as an entry point into Cardassian culture in general. Hold on.
Oren, this is a thing we need to do now.
Yeah, you know, I actually, when he said that, I was pretty sure we already had, but I don't think we have. I have to look at the archive. It's been, like, a long time. There are some
episodes. If you have, you haven't done it with me, so.
Yeah, that's true. We could,
incentive.
And, you know, there are things we could, you know, revisit, because now I've got you and David, and, like, you guys can have your own opinions about things. So that's the end of the email. Thank you, John, for sending it. And to answer the question that you asked, I might consider doing this on some of, like, the three-episode arcs from Enterprise Season 4 or for DS9. Mainly the reason I wanted to do the Zindi arc was because it represented like a huge shift for Enterprise, you know, for better or for worse. And I thought it was an interesting look at what they were trying to do to try to like basically reimagine the show. And we also got another
email for better or for worse.
Yeah. And we got another email from a Christopher who is not Christopher 13, and he had an interesting idea for like a Star Trek fantasy football type thing. I read the email. I think it was a little too complicated for me to understand, but I'll take another look at it, and maybe we'll visit that at some point. So for now, it's time to look at Enterprise episodes. And I think we had a few things left over from like, what is this, like 4 weeks ago now when we did Zindi, the episode?
Something like that, yeah.
Because we had like 3 weeks of guests.
I think we finished off on complimenting and simultaneously complaining about T'Pol's new look.
Yeah, I mean, it's better than that. Whatever that jumpsuit thing she was wearing before, but it's certainly not a great costume.
Yeah, I think the conclusion we came to was that it's better, but at the same time, it's really telling about the show that so much of them continuing the show was hinging on them rebooting her look.
Yeah, you know, and they changed her makeup, apparently, which I'll admit I didn't notice.
Yeah, they made her eyebrows look more Vulcan, which definitely looks better, definitely makes her look more Vulcan and less like a... girl in a frumpy jumpsuit with a Mo Howard haircut.
Yeah, that's
Why
fair.
I oughta.
Vulcan.
Yeah. All right. So there was basically one important point that I had left over from Zindi. Just, you know, not to get too much into the recap, but basically, my biggest issue with Zindi is in this episode we really see that Archer is a jerk. Like, so you have like. Trip and Archer, and they're both down, you know, trying to get this Zindi slave, basically, because they need information on the Zindi. And, like, okay, so Trip being a jerk, I can kind of understand. He's grieving, he hasn't really dealt with his issues, he's not objective. But, like, Archer is really mad at this guy, because the guy has, like, the audacity to want to not be a slave anymore. He's like, hey, Yuzin, you know, oh, go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, well, the guy isn't the most friendly of people to run into, but still, at the same time, Archer's just acting really aggro the whole time. Which is understandable if you're, you know, trapped in a labor camp and all, but still, diplomacy, man.
Well, it just shows me that Archer seems to be completely incapable of any sort of objective thinking. Because, like, you know, he's like, hey, Zindi, I want some information from you. And the Zindi's like, well, okay, but how about you help me out and I'll give you that information. And Archer is, like, really angry that the Zindi would dare to make that request.
They're like, what? Quid pro quo? That's ridiculous.
He just wants the information, and he's not interested in what the Zindi wants, and that the Zindi doesn't want to be a slave anymore. He's just like,
you
no,
scratch my back, and that's it.
Yeah, exactly. And,
yeah,
you know, again, I'm not saying that he shouldn't be angry. I mean, I don't, you know, it's hard for me to say how I would react if an alien blew up 7 million people, but I'd probably be angry. But at the same time, I would expect a captain, someone who's been trusted with that kind of authority, to be able to have some level of objectivity.
Again, diplomacy also.
Right. And then it gets worse, because like he almost leaves the Zindi guy behind because he was rude, basically. Like, you know, because they have that scene where they're trying to escape together, and like they're climbing up the mine shaft, and like the Zindi kind of panics and gets in Tucker's way, and they almost don't get out before they all get eaten by fire. And like because of that, Archer almost leaves him behind. And it's like, what? No, he still has that information you need, Archer. Why would you do that?
Yeah, Archer isn't doing very good at heroic protagonist right now. And we see that continue with the next episode also.
It's true, especially. And because I'm supposed to like Archer to some degree, right? Like, because a big part of the story...
In theory, yeah.
Yeah, a big part of the story we're going to see is that Archer has to, like, compromise his morals, but from what I've seen, he doesn't have any. Like, he doesn't seem to have any kind of, you know, objection to the fact that these
people
are slaves.
How can you compromise what you don't have?
Right, that's sort of, like, you know, if Archer's supposed to be a highly moral character who has to compromise for the sake of pragmatism, you know, I mean, not to say that one captain has to be like another, but why isn't he more like Picard? Just a little bit. All right, so Grace or David, do you guys have anything last you want to say on Zindi before we move on to the next episode that we're actually doing today?
Nothing that can't express through a lot of eye rolling.
Well, you know, that works really well in podcast form, right?
Yep.
All right,
But no,
go ahead.
Not really.
Fair enough. All right, so today we are talking about the episode Anomaly, which has no Zindi in it, but is still an important part of the Zindi story arc.
And well, we don't actually see the Zindi. We do see the effect kind of that they have on some people around them, sort of.
To an extent, it also plants the idea of the spheres. It establishes that the spheres exist, and those are going to be really important later. So, you know, it establishes that, and it's an important establishing episode for like what life in the expanse is like. So, you know, it's important for those reasons. There are a few episodes of season 3 that we're going to skip, but I wanted to do this episode because it's, you know, it's important for those reasons. Also, I just realized I'm not recording. David, we are going to be, we're recording through the SAM broadcaster, right?
Yeah, SAM's archiving as we go. My question is, I think I only saw part of Zindi, but I really haven't seen all of Enterprise. I need to go back and do a whole, you know, whole series rewatch, but this particular episode, Anomaly, where does it fit in the whole overarching Zindi arc? Is this towards the beginning? Is it towards the middle? Is this like, you know, where does this fit into that story arc of the whole, if you string them all together?
So this is the second episode of season 2. You know, the first episode of the Zindi arc is the last episode of season 2, right? It's the Expanse. And then there's Zindi, which is the first episode of season 2, or season 3, excuse me, the first episode of season 3. And then there's Anomaly, which is the second episode. And it follows, you know, almost directly after Zindi. There's, like, a little bit of a time jump, but it's not much. So to recap it very briefly, for anyone who doesn't remember what episode I'm talking about, the plot is that the Enterprise, quote, runs aground, unquote, on a spatial anomaly. Because, you know, they really like that idea. of that it, since this is a spaceship, it should be able to do things that a regular ship can do, so it'll run aground, I guess.
And of course we get the simplified line, basically we're out of gas.
That's the thing I took at it, you know, ran aground, it's like nautical ship related, but it all like that, we ran out of gas, and it reminded me of like, well, the thing's got to have a tailpipe. They like to do these little cute metaphors for the viewers to go like, oh, it's on empty, you know.
Yeah, to an extent. Although in this case,
it's the line
actually
from Futurama. We do a really, really long, complicated string of techno babble, and then simplify it with a simple analogy.
Like a balloon and something bad happening.
And there's too much air, and the balloon explodes.
So basically, what actually is happening here is that they've hit an anomaly that makes math work differently. Like the laws of the universe aren't constant, so all of the really complicated math that makes a warp drive work is not, you know, is not working correctly now. Which,
don't they kind of establish that the laws of physics are all wonky now too?
Right. And to be fair, you know, actual warp drives, like the theoretical ones that scientists are working on, those do involve a lot of extremely complicated math. So, you know, if you ran into a section of the universe where things didn't work the way they're supposed to, you know, you might have some trouble making your warp drive go.
That was another thing I thought that was interesting and kind of cool about this, the idea of that, because in other Trek, we've seen that, like, you know, there's pockets of anti-time or, you know, temporal anomalies where its time is being messed up, and then gravity or something, where I thought this was interesting to, you know, all of that's still normal, it's just physics is kind of off, and it made me think of, like, Scotty saying, I cannot rewrite the laws of physics, but now Trip and them have to deal with, you know, rewriting or rediscovering physics in this Expanse thing.
We get the incredibly less pithy, where's Isaac Newton when you need him?
Which is funny that he said that, because the warp drive doesn't work on Newtonian physics, like, even a little bit. Like, you know,
for me, it was just kind of a wah-wah-wah moment.
Yeah, it is a little bit. And apparently when you try to start the warp engine in a place where math is wrong, you get, like, a ball lightning effect. I don't know why exactly, but that's a thing that happens. It starts, like, acting like a giant Tesla coil, which could be a hit at parts.
No physics for you.
Nope.
No math for you. No physics.
That tripped me out, because I thought, wouldn't that have been contained? I mean, even if it's not working right and the intermix flux is off or whatever, it's like, oh, just lightning is shooting out of the thing now. That was weird.
Well, look, David, this is the same ship that if you put your hand in the wrong place on the elevator, it will cut your hand off. So
we've already established it's kind of a death trap.
Yeah, clearly operational safety is not something the designers of Enterprise really had in mind. All right. So after they run aground, the general plot is they get raided by pirates, and the pirates take all their stuff, and then they interrogate one of the pirates, and Archer is rude to him, and then they find the pirates, and the pirates are camped inside a giant space station thing, and they take their stuff back, and they leave. All right, so that's, there you go, that's the premise.
Well, now, because I didn't see much of the Zindi one, but also not seeing the course of the, you know, the whole series up until this point, I kind of was thinking, like when you guys were saying Archer is being a jerk, it was making me think, like, are we supposed to get the idea, or is this the execution manifestation of the idea that things are so dire that, you know, Archer is having to step outside himself and go against his morals. Like, they even mentioned in the episode, like, you know, your morals aren't going to do you much good out here. And then, oh, look, you're dropping your morals type of thing. And it just made me think it's kind of a weird approach from Archer. And I thought, this has got to be, you know, relating to the imminent danger and all that.
Yeah, we have a continuation of Archer having some kind of, wow, what's your deal issues? He tries to torture information out of someone by putting them in the airlock and depriving them of air. And that's kind of like the joke trope of, oh, get rid of the character, throw him in the airlock with Star Trek. But nope, Archer literally tries to throw someone in the airlock. And it's just a really weird scene, even knowing that Archer's supposed to be a good guy and all. It's just kind of like, well, that kind of came out of nowhere.
Yeah, see, the thing about Archer that I'm genuinely confused about is if he's supposed to be the flawed human of the 22nd century, or if he's legitimately supposed to be, like, a stand-up guy and he's just badly written. Because if he's supposed to be the flawed human of the 20th century, then I don't understand why he has this storyline about how he has to get over his morals, because that seems like he isn't terribly moral. But if he's supposed to be a genuine stand-up guy, why is he written like such a jerk? Like, he honestly reminds me of season one Picard.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, you know, Picard
in season one. At least he isn't as hutchety as season one Picard.
Yeah, but Picard had that same problem, right? Where they kind of, they wanted him to be this great, you know, moralistic character who, you know, always had his compass pointed in the right direction and knew what was up, but he was just a grumpy old man in season one. You know, fortunately for us, they finally got it right. But with Archer, I mean, they kind of get it right in season four, I guess. And you were talking about airlock decompression scene. So let's talk about that, because that one is one of the interesting parts of this episode.
Yeah, it also seems like he's willing to keep going, just letting the dude be stuck in there until he gets walked in on, as it were.
Yeah, the things that I noticed or that jumped out at me at that scene was that Archer is doing this, and it's almost like, you know, by any means necessary, or, you know, the ends justifies the means type of thing. But then you see, I think it was Malcolm Reed who comes in and is like, hey, you know, Archer, what are you doing? Hey, you're going too far type of idea. And you see like the little indicators dropping for the oxygen level. But it also, it was, you know, letting the oxygen escape out of the airlock. So he's suffocating. But what it also thought to me, what I thought of was almost basically waterboarding a person to get information out of them. And like, you know, that's not very cool for a Starfleet person. But, you know, they don't have the prime directive yet. They don't, it's not into Picard's era, and it's not, really not even Kirk's era yet. So I was kind of thinking.
But even without a prime directive, there should be a level of moral compass that everyone has where it's like,
right,
this is beyond okay where I'm going. Like, there should have been a better acknowledgement on Archer's part of him saying, okay, I'm kind of crossing a line here or something.
Yeah, he didn't really seem terribly torn up about it. He seemed more like he just did it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, he sort of ineffectually tries to get information out of the guy, and then he immediately jumps to airlock flushing. And he seems kind of, you know, it seems like something he's doing more out of frustration than because he's reached, you know, some kind of realization that these are desperate situations.
Like a boiling point, yeah.
Well, before he puts him in the airlock, he grabs the phaser and, like, puts the phaser to the guy's head. And even at that point, I'm thinking, wow, like, if that was, like, a cop show, or if that was, you know, thinking of, you know, the other Kirk or Picard or other Star Trek, it's like, you don't really see them put a phaser to a person's head, you know, threatening them. And then the alien guy's like, I don't think you have the guts to do it, basically. And so it's like, all right, fine, we're going to the airlock. It was just clearly crossing a line of, you know, morality and ethical conduct. But it was also showing that, like, oh, wow, Archer is going to get what it... It almost reminded me of, and I don't think it was as well done, but it reminded me of the in Pale Moonlight where Sisko is basically, you know, breaking...
Morality. Feels like what's what they were kind of going for, but it was still kind of early in this arc, and I don't feel like there was enough at stake at this point.
Yeah, the build-up.
They had him break a little too early.
But he says the line, like, I could live with it or whatever, like, you know, if he regrets it. I forget the exact line, but he basically says, like, I'll deal with that, I'll live with it, as long as he gets the outcome of... So I kind of didn't like that scene. I mean, it was interesting. So yeah,
it's also frustrating from a different perspective, in that the alien, he doesn't make very much sense. Like, he seems like his entire purpose in life is to push Archer's buttons. Like, because he's like, all he really does until, like, from the moment they capture him to when he's being in the airlock is tell Archer that he's too civilized to do anything rude. And, you know, and to do, you know, these extreme interrogation methods that are torture, basically.
Show you.
Yeah, and I'm kind of like, how does he know that? Like, he doesn't know. Yeah, go ahead.
What I picked up, or at least what I think they were trying to do, is say that this is a character who's been kind of forced into piracy with his crew to survive, and has kind of, other than that, just kind of given up, and just like, whatever, I don't have any reason to be civil or to be friendly and help these guys out or whatever. I'm just gonna be kind of dickish and see if it kills me or whatever.
Well,
that's what I got.
Another layer that I thought after, like, watching the episode, and I don't remember what order of these two scenes, but I remember they said, like, that guy, the bad guy, that race, those people, they were basically just, you know, traders, merchants, doing legitimate business and stuff.
And then they got stuck in this area, yeah.
Right, and then that guy, like, shows his face is all, like, you know, distorted of the skin and the muscle, all that, showing that, like, you know, the physics are going to cause problems, not just with your tech, but maybe his face got distorted. So, and it aside from that side of it, I thought that was, like, a visual representation of showing how the person, the culture of those people got twisted, so now they're forced into the piracy. And I started thinking, maybe showing Archer doing what he was doing is supposed to show that, you know, even good people will do bad things under certain circumstances.
Yeah, like that this is a place that will change you and stuff.
Right.
Will twist you almost.
Make your face look like silly putty anyway. And that's not like... That's not a story that I'm against, right? Like, I love In the Pale Moonlight. I am totally for examining what people will
That's
do.
That's because it's told well. It's the difference between this and In the Pale Moonlight.
But, like, this story just doesn't work for me because... And another thing that weirded me out is, okay, so the alien finds out that Archer wants information on the Zindi. And at that point, that means the alien has a bargaining chip that he can use. He can be like, hey, Archer, you would like information on the Zindi. I would like to not be your prisoner anymore, or something like that. And this is, unlike anything else, this is information he can give to Archer without having to endanger his ship. But he doesn't seem interested. He just continues to tell Archer that he's too civilized, because apparently he's an expert on humans. Would be kind of funny if he had run into, like, some Klingons, and he's like, you Klingons are too civilized to hurt me, and then the Klingons just started beating his ass.
You don't know us! And then they just start wailing on him.
Because, you know, again, I didn't see any indication that he knew who the Federation were. I mean, you know, heck, what if this was the Mirror Universe? He's like, you're too civilized, put him in the agony booth.
Well, you said the Federation, and that's the thing that I always sometimes have to remind myself when I was watching Enterprise is, towards the end, we see the formation, but for a lot of Enterprise, there is no Federation, it's just... And Starfleet is just like the Earth Starfleet, and the Vulcans are helping him, and so... That again is like, if it's just the Earth Starfleet, how would all these other races know about Earth? And like, unless they're like reading the Vulcan
word travels
CNN,
fast, I guess.
You know, the Vulcan CNN is giving reports on the Earth and humanity, and other races are like, oh, we need to study these people.
See, this is why, like, there's another one of Enterprise's many missteps, is that they should have really, instead of meeting a new alien race every week, they should have been focusing on, these are a group of aliens that live around Earth. Because frankly, they aren't going to be that far from Earth, right? At warp 4, they aren't getting that far. But instead, it's like a new alien every week. So we meet these guys, and they're not supposed to really know anything about humans and vice versa. But if they had been another alien species that we'd met earlier and like were close to Earth, then it would make sense. Then he'd know about Earth and be like, yeah, we know you. We know you're pretty cool and that you aren't going to do these rude things to us. But instead, he doesn't. And again, it bothers me that he is acting. It's like, you know, they were like, hey, we need a guy who's going to push Archer's buttons. And then instead of writing a character who, by his nature, will push Archer's buttons, they just wrote a guy who pushes Archer's buttons. Like, he was created with that goal, and then he immediately disappeared the moment he walked off their transporter pad.
He had his niche, he fulfilled it, and he left, I guess.
Right, which is part of the reason why I think this scene doesn't work for us, where In the Pale Moonlight did. I also was surprised that the guy's ship would want him back after he gave up all their information.
Yeah, that too. I'm surprised they didn't put him in another airlock.
I mean, maybe they did. We'll never know. Also, in Star Trek, nobody ever changes their codes. Like, hey, our guy got captured. Should we change our codes? We'd have to memorize new codes. Like, that would be hard.
Today we learned that all aliens in space in Star Trek are your grandma in that sense.
Exactly. They don't want to change the password. They took them like,
this
you know,
has always been my password.
It took them like a month.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Don't use your birthday, man. Space pirates are great. So, you know, that...
The best.
Another thing that's odd about this episode is that it's like T'Pol's turn to offer stupid advice. Like, did you notice that? There are two instances where T'Pol offers Archer some advice that he can angrily shoot down, but it's like really bad advice.
That's actually something I've noticed about Paul a bunch of the time, is she's kind of used as the bad advice straw man for Archer to have something to get mad at and do it his own renegade way. And that's kind of her main purpose that I've seen.
Yeah, it's like
aside from the TNA.
Well, and when that happens, there's times where I would get the feeling that, like, the writers are trying to give the impression, or at least from Archer's view, it's like, is she giving me, like, good advice, or is she holding back information? Are the Vulcans screwing us over again? It's like, it was just, you know, it was weird when that would pop up.
Because, like, in particular, the two pieces of advice that she gives are that they should stay where they are instead of moving on while Trip is trying to fix the wormhole. Because Archer is the warp drive. Because Archer's like, let's move away from here at Impulse. And T'Pol's like, maybe we should stay here. And her justification is that there might be more spatial anomalies out there. But, like, they know there's a spatial anomaly right here. And it's a bad one. And it's keeping the warp drive from working.
Yeah, she's a fan of the stick with the devil you know philosophy.
Hey, I suppose. And they also know there's pirates in the area. So under what, you know, what chain of logic is it a good idea to stay where they are?
A stupid chain of logic, obviously.
Yeah, well, you know. And then when Archer's like, we're going to go after those guys and get our stuff back because, you know, they got their stuff stolen by pirates. T'Pol is like, maybe we shouldn't do that. Maybe we could replenish our supplies somewhere else. And it's like, how are you going to do that? Like, there's no currency. You can't offer, like, a passing merchant, you know, Earth bucks for his stuff. And so, is your hold, like, just full of trade goods that you don't need? Like, you know, we saw how hard it was just to get the stuff to see, like, one prisoner in the last episode. It was like, we needed to scrape all this platinum off of our conduits. It's like, I hope we didn't need that platinum.
They probably did. They're going to have a massive platinum shortage in a few episodes or something.
And it's like, so, you know, then, like, T'Pol, but, like, the fact that T'Pol, like, suggests that basically just so Archer can snap at her, and it's kind of like, you know,
advice straw man, that's what she does.
Exactly, and I just, it weirds me out, because I don't think T'Pol is supposed to be dumb. I guess that's their way of making Archer look smarter.
Exactly, that's what I'm saying. She's there to give bad advice, so he looks better giving the supposedly way better advice as opposed to her stupid advice.
All right, so guys, I think we're going to try this next week. So next week, Grace, I want you to tell me that Threshold is, like, the best episode ever, and that way I will look really smart for showing you that you're wrong. Are we good?
Yeah, cool with that? I'm not throwing myself under that bus.
God damn it, Grace, why do you got to have, like, free will and stuff?
Because I'm pain like that. I'm a rebel.
Uh-oh. Archer's a rebel. Do you want to be like Archer? He's crazy.
Can I have a better haircut and a less frumpy uniform?
You know, come on. You can't hate the overall uniforms. Those uniforms are hilarious.
Really?
They have pockets in the shoulders.
They all look like they're running around in pajamas or mechanics uniforms.
Which, I mean, you know, kind of makes sense for the engineering crowd to be wearing those. Cause, you know,
yeah, but with like the science officers and stuff, shouldn't they be wearing something a little less baggy?
Well, they need science-y stuff to put in their pockets. So it's not wrenches, but it's some other science thing. Beakers and test tubes.
I'm also like saying that, like, most other forms of military and such will have, like, a civilian uniform or something that looks a little less like a jumpsuit to wear if you're in a meeting or something like that. Why don't they have that? They're just constantly in their jumpsuits.
Well, we did get that scene where they were all in their underwear when they were putting on their when they put on their spacesuits.
No.
And so
chick looked like she was wearing a sports bra made out of a napkin. Like, it looked like a brocade napkin made into underwear.
Look, that's the style of the future, Grace.
Everyone wearing matching underwear?
Are you not prepared for the grand revolution of fashion that takes place after First Contact? It's going to be brocade underwear for everybody.
No, no, don't say it.
Although I will give the episode credit for this at least. The scene where they show a bunch of people in their underwear is at least them like changing into new gear and not like having a rub down in decon.
We still get a bunch of lingering shot of people's abs and biceps, though.
Yeah, we do, but I'm a little bit more willing to accept it, because it feels like, you know, I mean, granted, it's a little gratuitous, but it's still like, okay, this is a thing that would happen, right? Like, at some point they have to change.
Gratuitous
from their
within
normal...
reason, you mean?
Yeah, it's, you know, at some point they have to change from their normal uniform into their spacesuit, and we
all in
put
one
the camera...
room together, though.
Yeah,
even
apparently.
The gym has little changing booths.
Well, it kind of had shades of Starship Troopers, where they were all just co-ed locker rooms, but, you know...
Talk about excuses for TNA.
And it also shows that they're less, you know, evolved or advanced because, you know, when in First Contact, when Worf and Picard put on their EVA suit, they didn't have to take off their uniform and get into their underwear together. But, you know, earlier in the Enterprise era... you had to take off your baggy, pockety jumpsuit to fit into your EVA suit.
They didn't have the multipus undersuit thing yet.
Well, in real life, you have to wear, like, what's basically long underwear to put on a spacesuit, because it's like, you have to be super well insulated or you will be in trouble.
Yeah.
Probably not wearing a sports bra under there, just, you know, as a rule.
Especially not one that doesn't actually look like it provides any actual support. Seriously, it hung like a little tank top. It was ridiculous.
Yeah. It's just a napkin. It's just what they... It's not actually her
top. She was wearing a tankini. That's what she was wearing.
Only for the least stylish of Marines, I would say. I wouldn't say for the most stylish, because it's not a very stylish look.
Now, what I wondered is, why was it all just, you know, bland, like, gray? It seems like every time, you know, all their uniforms have their department colors, what if something happened at that moment where it was like, you know, we're changing, but, oh, red alert, something's happening... You wouldn't know who's science, who's engineering, tactical. They should have had, like, a little red stripe.
Are you saying
they
should have identifying underwear?
Right, you know, red for the tactical.
Okay, why not? Makes about as much sense as anything else.
Well, I mean, clearly...
And pocket. You gotta have a pocket somewhere.
That would have given them an excuse to have, like, the entire episode where everyone's just in their underwear, because we can still tell them apart, right? I mean, why even wear
We didn't have
uniforms?
Enough of that already? Yeah.
This is the future. Your primitive concept of modesty is long forgotten.
Hmm.
Although, speaking of the underwear sequence, that does lead to what I think is probably the best part of the episode, which is when they go over to the alien ship that's already been hit by the pirates.
Yeah, that was cool.
Yeah.
It was creepy. We saw
My
aliens.
Favorite part is when we get the standard open the door and the body falls out onto you thing. It's like, did someone kill him and prop him up in there just so that would happen?
And then they walk into the next room, and there's just, like, bodies just floating in the air in the middle of the room. It's like, why was the one in a closet, and then the others are just out in the open?
But, again, well, I think a pirate was just like, oh, we'll do this. It'll be really funny if anyone comes for them.
Actually, there is the fact that dead bodies on a ship gravitate to the nearest door. Like, you know, that's just a rule.
And then the door closes behind.
Yeah.
It's like, why did that guy go to... I forget who it was, if it was Malcolm or whoever, but... They're all walking through, and they're like, you know, no life signs or whatever. And then he just starts to open this door. It's like, you don't know what's behind that door. Why? If it was just a closet, it's like, oh, look, here's a door. Let me open it. And there's, of course, a body inside. So it's like, why didn't they just keep walking? And I don't know. It was just...
A door, you open it, I guess. It's the Enterprise way.
Although I can tell you how that guy ended up in the closet. It actually makes a very tragic kind of sense. So, you know how the ship lost life support? Like, basically the story is that they got hit by the pirates and they didn't have enough resources to keep going.
Yeah.
And most of them suffocated. Well, that guy was the last one on the ship to die because he rerouted what little power there was left to keep the smallest room he could find livable for, like, the last few hours as everyone else died outside.
I'll allow it. I'll allow it, yeah.
So, I mean, in the future, on these freighter-type ships... The closets are airlocked, sealed, you know, environmental. Okay, because you got to keep your clothing, you know, fresh smelling, so you lock in all the air in that little...
Right. Well, logically, every room on a spaceship is airtight, right? Like, it doesn't make sense for you to have a door on a ship that isn't airtight. Like how, I'm pretty sure, granted I haven't served on a submarine, but as I recall from when I was on one... Pretty much every hatch is watertight. Like,
well, for water, that makes sense. But well, and so then when that guy opened the door, it should have made like a because of the pressure escaping, right? That would
Should have heard a psh sound.
Well, I mean, they've been there for a while, right? So like, life support gave out a long time ago, and it's not that it's
he lost his carbonation. Then we didn't get the psh
sound. He went flat.
No.
What I was assuming is that there wasn't that there was no air on the ship. I'm assuming that there was just too much carbon dioxide. Like, it was probably what happened was that, because there was no like big gaping hole in the ship, right? So it's not like they lost all their atmosphere. It was just that they had, you know, assuming they're oxygen breathers, they had turned too much of the air into carbon dioxide, and their scrubbers weren't working well enough to, you know, keep it breathable. So that's why I imagine there wasn't like a pressure sound. That at least that's my theory. It's a big, you know, it does kind of raise the question of why Reed felt it was necessary to open the door to a closet without scanning to see what was inside.
Because it was there.
You just open, you know, open every door you run into.
Pull out all the drawers.
It's called exploring, yeah. Oren.
It is true. So I appreciated that, and I appreciated that it was in zero gravity. The special effects are a little bit iffy, but I'm willing to, you know, I'll let them go because it was, you know, the early 2000s, and it was.
What,
you know,
I still love
this.
Is that at the beginning we get the scene where there's like the big ripple of math and physics going wonky, and Archer's cup gets knocked into the air, and there's coffee floating, and he comes back later, and it's still just floating there. It's like, really, you didn't think to clean that up or anything? You just let it kind of float there?
Well, and
it had gotten into your computer or something.
Apparently, the Expanse doesn't like food related items, because there's the scene in the mess hall thing where they're all just eating their, you know, whatever, and all the cups and plates
with
just,
some,
you know,
incredibly bland extra reactions in that scene.
Yeah, well, because all of their plates and cups and everything just like shot up to the ceiling, and I thought, oh, gravity is reversed, but wait, why are they all just still sitting on their tables and chairs and walking on the floor? So only the gravity reversal only applied to the cutlery, the plates, and the food. That was
kind
of
a really
weird.
Dickish anomaly, then, isn't it? It just knocks people over and makes it so they can't eat or drink their coffee.
I assumed that it was supposed to be a magnetic field, and that was supposed to be those plates were all looked like they were made of metal. Like, that was my assumption, because otherwise it doesn't, you know, I don't know why the food didn't go with them, right? Or anyone else in the room. So I assumed it was magnetics. But other, you know, who knows? Maybe it is just a dish-hating anomaly, right? It's just like, you guys are having a meal. I'm going to ruin that.
How dare you!
They didn't invite me. And that wave that traveled through the floor, across the tables, that was trippy, too. But,
just knocking people over.
Yeah, it also that actually wasn't a spatial anomaly. That was just like one of the crew members got under the carpet and was freaking everyone out.
I kind of expected almost like a Bugs Bunny to pop up, you know, when he's like burrowing under the floor and it makes the big bump where as he's traveling and then he pops out. But
what's up, Voyager? No, wait, what's up, Enterprise?
No,
I should have taken the right current at Albuquerque.
There was that one cool scene right as they're going into that no gravity freighter thing, where the shuttle is like flying, and he's like, "Do you see that hatch? You know, Mayweather."
And it flips upside down.
They just do the 180 upside down, and
it seemed a little unnecessary, but okay.
No, yeah, I really like that, because it. I hate how in Star Trek they all. Well, I don't hate, but it frustrates me how in Star Trek they all pretend that everyone is oriented the same way. Like, yeah. All the ships have their top facing the same direction. And I appreciated how it showed us that from the perspective, if you look up at the Enterprise looks like it's upside down when they're on the sphere, right? Because it's orbiting with its top facing toward the sphere. So it's not just, you know, I appreciated that they actually play a little bit with perspective.
Just part of me wishes that when we'd had the shot of it flipping itself down, we could have heard everyone in the shuttle go, whoa! Maybe someone puking in the background.
Well, the questions of how artificial gravity on a starship works are definitely up for debate. But, you know, I appreciated it even then. I was willing to give it a pass. Now, since we're coming up on the end of the show already, wow, that didn't feel like that much time. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the spheres. Because, again, those are going to be important later. And this episode basically establishes what they are and how they are causing all these spatial anomalies, which I thought was kind of odd that they figured that out so quickly, because,
yeah,
like, you know, later on, I forget, Grace, how much of the Zindi arc have you seen?
This is as far as I've gotten.
All right, so you don't know what's coming, but basically, they're going to be, you know, established to be part of a much larger plan later, and they're apparently,
of course,
you know, they're causing these spatial anomalies, and apparently that's not hard to figure out. Like, you know, Enterprise scans them and figures it out inside of, like, 5 minutes. So the question then becomes, has no one ever tried to destroy one of these things? Because, like, that doesn't, it doesn't, you know, it seems like these anomalies are bad. Like, nobody likes them. But for, you know, but it's also pretty obvious, apparently, that these spheres are the cause. So has no one ever tried to blow one up?
Mm-hmm. Like, it's, you know,
I think this was a mistake that they made, which was establishing so early on what the spheres did. I think it would have been better if they had kept it a little bit more, you know,
built a little more tension.
Yeah, a little bit more mysterious, because there are certain episodes later that are going to make less sense because we know what the spheres do. And then at the same time, I kind of, you know, that scene where they, you know, fly inside one is kind of neat, and, like, you know, they find a little pirate base, and then I also, you know,
get their stuff back. They're able to get, you know, a lot of the stolen goods back, but and it was interesting.
Look at all the stem bolts.
But not self-sealing, so that was sad.
So
that,
they're useless. Just throw them out the airlock.
Yeah, they get into the inside of it, and then they're flying in, and it's like a big, it looked like a big power plant or a big thing in the middle, and then there's like, oh, that little corner over there, there's like pockets of air, and that's where their stuff is. But then later, T'Pol says, like, there's like generators or big, you know, power plant things or something inside, and there were supposed to be like 7 of them, but only 3 were working, and I thought, like, I didn't get that whole thing. Was that they were being, you know, shut down? Was it just so old that it was, like, you know, breaking down? Or did somebody, damage or destroy it? And I was like, what is this whole sphere thing? And then they leave it and go back, you know, to the Enterprise. And then there's the whole, the area that was, like, cloaked, where you see the ships, you know, flying, and then they start disappearing gradually as they go into this cloaked area. I didn't get what that was about. I mean, it was around the sphere, but it's like what the sphere was generating it. Was that part of the anomalies? It was just kind of confusing because I only saw that once, and I need to go back and watch this whole Zindi thing again.
Yeah, you have to pay attention. If you miss something, you'd be a little confused. Like the cloaking field is like clearly a defense mechanism. They sort of make that clear, is that it has a cloaking field because someone didn't want everyone knowing where these things were. Now, they're so big that apparently some people just fly into them randomly, right? Which is maybe, you know, kind of defeats the point a little bit. And the fusion reactor thing, where they're like, that has this many reactors and these many of them have turned off, I assume that's just supposed to be, like, further reinforcing how old the thing is, because it's supposed to be, like, 1,000 years old.
Oh, that's like right. T'Pol said, like, these things have been here for 1,000 years or whatever.
Yeah, and so it just, you know, it's been there for a long time, and it's, like, only some of it is working, and it also kind of raises the question of, like, is it almost finished with what it's supposed to be doing? Like, why, you know, who put it there? Which, and these are all good questions, and I was worried when I first saw this episode that was never going to be answered, right? Like, they were just going to leave and pretend this fear never happened. But, you know, fortunately, they do come back to it later. And, you know, Hoshi got to be useful this episode. I'll give this episode that,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, that was surprising. Good for her.
She's like a hacker and stuff. That was cool to see, like, the Zindi language or symbols or whatever. But yeah, she was like getting
the little mushy blot. Yeah.
now it made it to me. It made it seem, because I haven't seen, you know, the upcoming episodes, the rest of the Zindi arc. So I'm not, you know, knowing what from here, what's going to happen after that. But it made me feel like they really needed that Zindi database. Like, that would either, you know, help them survive or help them take down the Zindi. And so it just kind of was like, not tension or drama, but it's like, I got 80%, I got 90%. And it's like, I was like, yay, download that, like, get that data. So, but I didn't know why. It's like, but so that was kind of interesting to see her doing the computer thing. And then at the end, Archer comes in and tells the computer, like, load the database, and the color, the, you know, displays all colors on his face, and I'm like, ooh, this is, like, ominous or interesting or, you know, foretelling of something to come.
We get another example of everyone uses the same format in Star Trek. It'd be kind of funny if they tried to download the file and was like, what is a .exe? Like, we're all running macOS over here. How do we open this file?
Futuristic, and it's still running on Mac.
Look, Mac will have taken over the world by the 22nd century, I'm pretty sure. But, you know, the silliness of being able to hack someone else's computer from your spaceship aside, it's cool to see, you know, Hoshi actually getting to do something. Although, again, in another
example,
that fits
within her actual skill set, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But in another example of T'Pol giving bad advice, She says, that other ship is heavily armed. Do we really want to go after them? And then when the Enterprise actually fights it, it turns out, well, no, not really. Like, the only reason they're even having trouble is because they're not trying to blow it up. They're trying to, you know, stay close to it and take its data core. And, like, so, you know, it doesn't actually seem that heavily armed. Like, none of its shots seem to have that much effect against Enterprise.
Yeah, that was weird. Another scene that I thought was, you know, fun, I don't know, it stood out or whatever, was we get another scene of Phlox, you know, doing medicine with leeches.
So that was actually a part that stood out to me especially, because we have a point where they're talking about how they can help Trip sleep, and they're like, well, you could keep doing the creepy, weirdly sexual massage thing with T'Pol, or we can give you these leeches. And what I'd really hoped for is that we would have had, like, just a pause of him considering there for a minute, like, oh, leeches or creepy massage? Leeches, creepy massage. But he's like, nah, I'll just go back with T'Pol. I was like, damn, you should have gone with the leeches.
Yeah,
well, because Phlox said he had to stay on his back. He couldn't just roll over because the leeches would be on his chest and his stomach. And he's like, but I like to roll over and toss and turn. So if I have to stay on my back, I'll just go to deal with T'Pol.
But considering how awkward and creepy the thing with T'Pol was last time, it was worth considering.
We have more of Phlox trying to force Trip and T'Pol into having creepy erotic massage. And also, you know, okay, so this is a minor point of minorest points, but so the eel or the leech thing. So the reason why he suggests the neuropressure in the first place is because apparently he thinks that these stimulants, or not stimulants, but these sedatives that he's giving Tucker are harmful. Like, they won't work. They'll cause harm over a long period of time, which is fine. You know, that's probably true. But then he turns around and says, hey, this leech is great, and it uses a natural sedative. And it's like, wait, what?
Maybe he was worried of running out of sedatives or something. Who knows?
Like, it's not like there's a magical distinction between natural and artificial sedatives, right? Like, natural sedatives can cause just as much damage over the long run as artificial ones. And so
now he's going to get hooked on leeches or something.
So, you know, really, if these
Come
leeches...
Come on, Phlox, I need another leech. Just give me one more leech.
You're wearing one right now, aren't you?
And then, like, if these leeches really do, produce a sedative that is harmless, like, that can be taken for long periods without causing side effects, why doesn't he try to synthesize it instead of leaving it in the leech? You know, like...
Well, even that, leeches?
Well, like, synthesizing would be, like, all science-y and tough. Why not just, like, you know, squeeze the leech, like, you know, get some of the juice out of the gland or whatever? I don't know.
If we ever make a Klingon punk leech band, juice. I'm calling it... If we make a Klingon punk band, I'm calling it Squeeze the Leech. So, okay, so that's my little beef on that. But I think, overall, I think this episode is decent. I think it does build up the plot that's going to occur. Archer's still a jerk, but Archer's always a jerk. So, as by Enterprise standards, I think this one works pretty well. You guys, final thoughts?
Yeah, it was all right.
It wasn't. I mean, it had issues, but you know, it did have some interesting, kind of fun, enjoyable moments, and so it did make me want to know more. Like, you know, follow to the next episode or to the next dealing with the Zindi and this whole expanse. So it kind of made me want to, you know, keep going with the story. So that's always a good thing. It's not like I'm done with this or, you know. But so I didn't mind watching it.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for joining us for this little abbreviated episode of All Things Trek. Next week, we will be joined by Kathy Ferguson once again, and we will be discussing the philosophy of Machiavelli in Star Trek. Until then, this is All Things Trek, signing off.
Direct from the database, it's Data Logan's Datalog.
One is my name. The other is not.
2014, February 8th. I've never gotten into Twitter or things like it, like Facebook and things. I'm still stuck in the 90s, I guess, using email and text messaging. But if anything might tempt me into getting into Twitter, it would certainly be First Time Trekker. It just sounds like so much fun experiencing Star Trek again with somebody like that. I am going through a similar fun project with my brother, introducing him to Star Trek for the first time, and we text back and forth about it while he's watching the episodes. And it is a lot of fun, but I can certainly be enticed to have that with yet another person. It's funny, my brother right now is watching the original series, so he's in the same place as First Time Trekker. Except First Time Trekker seems to be, for the most part, watching it in aired order. Whereas I have my brother watching it in a sort of unique order, not aired or production order. What I did was I took the entire series and I ordered it in the order from what I thought was roughly the worst episode to the best episode. Because the original series is so episodic, it can really be watched in any order. So I just thought it would be fun for him to watch it in an order where he knows almost every time the next episode's going to be a little bit better than the one before. Because it's sort of disappointing to watch it in production order or aired order, and you have that slow degradation of the show into the third season. First Time Trekker also talked a little bit about the episode The Child and how there are all these male Starfleet officers who were trying to decide what was going to happen to Troy's baby. It's certainly an interesting episode, one of the only times in Trek where you have a pregnancy outside of wedlock, outside of somebody really wanting the child. And I think the only time in Trek where abortion is actually mentioned, like, not even in metaphor. I mean, Worf just, during that meeting, explicitly states we should terminate the child. Although it never really happened on screen that Troy dealt with the emotions of that, much past the episode. I mean, because basically the whole thing is forgotten and never mentioned again. There was a book, at least one book, where Troy does deal with these kind of issues. TNG novel number 16, Contamination by John Vornhart. In that novel, Worf and Troy have to team up on a murder investigation. And during that time period, she's dealing with this whole, I don't really like Worf because he wanted to abort my child, that bastard. You know? So these feelings that Troy goes through in the novel, and she sort of gets over it and becomes a bit more friends with him. Because on the show, they hadn't really been together much. I mean, they don't interact much. And it's sort of an interesting stepping stone from their early relationship, which was more adversarial, to the book where they sort of develop their friendship, and then later in the show where they have their quote-unquote romance. All right, Data out.